Now, if you'll recall from last week, where we left off was at the end of chapter 4, where Mordecai has urgently asked Esther to intervene in the destruction that's about to happen to the Jews at the behest of Haman. And we asked the question, in looking at Psalm 27:14, 37:34, and Proverbs 20:22, that all advise the hearer to wait for the Lord. How do we reconcile that with Esther's stance and her reasonable in her reply to Mordecai? If we're to wait for the salvation of the Lord, but Mordecai says if you don't do anything, you might be destroyed, what's the reconciliation for those two thoughts together? Go ahead, Rob.
Turn to 1 John 4.
Okay.
Verse 17.
1 John 4, 17. All right.
And it states, there's no fear in love, but perfect... wrong verse. Herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment... Because he is, so are we in this world. You have to be bold even in the day of judgment. And Esther shows that, especially when you get to the next chapter, 1 through 4.
That is an absolutely excellent verse to apply to this situation. We see all those things, don't we? We see Esther acting with boldness. This is a day of judgment. Okay, great. Brother Dabney. He's coming.
God works through people. So here's Esther's opportunity to be one of those that God works through.
God works through people. And so we have to take action. We don't just sit around and wait. Sometimes that waiting is an active type of thing. I was laid off in January. If I wait for the Lord to present me with a new job, I might be waiting for a very long time. I have to act. I have to go look and apply for work. Esther goes and looks and applies herself. Rachel.
Even the farmer, like, he prays for rain, but he goes and plants his seeds to do that. And we're told to be obedient and do right. God saves us. He tells us in Acts over and over again that salvation begins when we accept Jesus and then we're baptized. So actions are important.
And Scott?
Oh, actions are still important. It is still the grace of God.
Exactly. And so we see all of those things here in Esther. We see God's grace and his mercy and his providence all at work. And we're going to get into providence a little bit more in chapter 5. But we want to finish off this by Esther tells them to send a reply to Mordecai. Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So first of all, what is Esther asking for? Okay. So typically, fasting goes with prayer. We've seen lots of verses in the Bible where fasting and prayer are going together. And she asks for a 3-day fast. How many? Out of curiosity, does anybody know how long were the typical Jewish fasts? They were usually only for a day. It was usually only 1 day. So Esther is asking for something extraordinary here, isn't she? She's saying, please pray and fast on my behalf for 3 days. And again, even though we don't see the mention of God explicitly in Esther, we see the evidence of the Jews worshiping God and relying on him in these verses. All right, so Esther now takes up the challenge. And what does the phrase, if I perish, I perish, remind you of? Is there anything else in the Bible that's kind of like that? Okay, somebody has Daniel chapter 3 and verse 17, right? Go ahead, Chandler.
If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor do we worship the gold image which you have set up.
That's the same attitude that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are presenting Nebuchadnezzar with. And it isn't fatalistic at all. It's not saying, well, if it's time for me to die, I'm going to die. Instead, it is hopeful. It's saying, I am relying on God to carry me through this. And if he chooses not to, that's okay also, that something else will come and arise. That's what Daniel and his friends answer the king with. They say, hey, our God is able to deliver us. And if he doesn't, we're still going to do what we know we are supposed to. That's Esther's answer. She's saying, I understand. This is something that I need to do, and I accept the consequences of that, whatever they may be. All right, so even though there's no indication that the fast assumed religious significance, Greek texts add that it was accompanied by prayer. So again, we have that idea that fasting and prayer typically go together in the Bible. All right, anything else on chapter 4 before we close that out and start in on chapter 5? All right, in that case, let's read Esther chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. And I have that on. All right, Jared's got that.
All right, Esther 5, chapter 5, verse 1 through 8. Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And it happened when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it will be given to you. And Esther said, if it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? For it shall be granted to you, and what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. So Esther answered and said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says.
All right, so the scene changes rather dramatically here. We go from fasting to feasting. We're going from the Jews to the royal court. And you'll notice that we're no longer calling Esther just Esther. She is now what? She's now Queen Esther. All right, so she's going from the representative of her people to a representative of the court. And that language shift is deliberate. It's to put us in mind that this is now part of the politics of the realm that are playing out. The opening phrase, on the third day, connects with this narrative with the previous one. So when is Esther going into the king? As the fasting ends, right? So Esther's approach to the king coincides with the third day of the fast that she has asked for. All right, so this is the inner court was situated directly to the north of the throne hall. Access to the court was tightly restricted as it gave direct access to the king with a straight line of sight to the throne. The king's quarters is literally the king's house, and it's to be distinguished from the palace as a whole, which also included the house of women and the various courts. It should be likely identified with the area surrounding the throne hall. It's noteworthy that this area is the most central in the larger palace complex and that it has particularly thick walls, perhaps indicating that there was a second story to it. So you can see here's the inner court here. Here is where the throne hall was, and the king's quarters here. So from the inner court, you have this direct line of sight to the throne. Okay, we went. That one went next, that one didn't. All right. So here we have the depiction of the king. You'll notice he has the scepter in his hand here. This is a relief of Darius and Xerxes. Xerxes is actually standing behind Darius. He's on the throne. And this predates his reign slightly, so that's his dad up there. It may be presumed that Xerxes sat on a similar throne, if not this same one exactly. This relief was photographed at the National Museum of Iran. Every time the king is depicted on his throne in Persian art, he's holding that scepter in his right hand. So that's the scepter that he extended towards Esther. You'll notice that it's pretty long. It's a rather long thing, so he didn't have to, she didn't have to approach very far for him to extend that out to her. All right, and again, that was photographed at the National Museum of Iran. This photograph shows a closer view of the inner court and the throne room. The throne pedestal in the area of the Apadana is that throne room mentioned in Esther chapter 2. So that's right, or excuse me, 1 verse 2. Here's that throne room. There's the inner courtyard where she was standing. So you can see approximately the distance between those areas there. And incidentally, the Apadana over here, this is where the party was held. That's the area that's the size of the Jones Crossing HEB. It seems appropriate that the king asks Esther what she wants in light of her unusually bold move to get noticed. His question is literally, "What is to you?" His offer that she could be given even up to half the kingdom is probably a conventional phrase. We've seen that before, right? Where else do we see that? Who else was offered up to half the kingdom for a request? Herodotus' daughter, exactly. Dancing, and she asks for the head of John the Baptist instead. Half a kingdom seems better than a head, if you ask me. But it's an indication that the supplicants can expect generosity and express their request with confidence. Coming from Xerxes, it's reminiscent of this kind of have what you like, do as you please attitude that he's given to Haman in the past. So, what does Esther do? She immediately requests that he stops the destruction of her people. No. All right. Instead, she invites Xerxes and Haman to a banquet. Now, I find it interesting what she does here. I want to relate this to something that happens in the business world. If you're an employer or an employee that works with computers, you have to guard against phishing attacks, right? What do phishing attacks do? Well, someone tries to access something they shouldn't by getting you to agree to something without knowing what it is, right? You get those emails that say, click here for whatever it is. And if you've done any kind of anti-phishing training for yourself or your employees, you know that one of the tactics that they use is what? What do all those say that you have to, how do you have to respond to those emails? What do they want you to think? It's urgent. Urgency is their weapon of choice, right? So what does Esther say? She says, she invites Xerxes to a banquet, and what does she say about the banquet? Does she have to go fix it? I've already prepared it. She's adding urgency to this. Come to the banquet. It's already ready. So she's getting Xerxes to make a decision promptly, without putting a whole lot of thought into what he's agreeing to, right? It's a phishing attack. Back in the 6th century BC. All right, so most phishing attacks don't typically prompt you by something that sets off a warning, right? It's something that you feel like is normal. You have a package ready. Click this link to check the tracking on it. Urgent response is required. Someone tried to sign into your account without authorization. Come to the banquet that I've already prepared. All right, and she gets him in. So she pulls Xerxes in with something that seems perfectly normal, perfectly natural. Why wouldn't the queen invite me to a banquet? And the language that Xerxes uses in response is what? He responds with that same urgency, doesn't he? He says, hurry and get Haman so we can do as Esther requested. So he's hooked. Phishing attack successful. So now Esther embarks on a project of building further rapport. Again, does she ask for something right away? No, she doesn't. She says, I tell you what, this has been a great success. How about if we come back and do this again tomorrow? Same time, and you bring Haman, and we'll talk business then. That's another common business tactic, right? What do we call that?
Procrastination.
Okay. I'm thinking of the particular tactic where we're inviting somebody out to a meal.
Oh,
Wining and dining. Yes, that's exactly what she's doing here. So we have two business tactics that Esther employs. Nothing new under the sun, right? So here she's, first we've got the fishing attack, now we've got wining and dining. And what's really interesting is, look at verse 8. She uses the king's own words in her response. What does she say? She says, "If it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, may the king come to the banquet I will prepare for them." What is she implying? If the king comes to the banquet, then what? Then he's going to comply. So him coming to the banquet is tacit agreement to her condition or her request already. She's effectively binding the king to agree to her request by agreeing to come to the banquet on the morrow. So she's set this whole thing up and very carefully maneuvered the king into a position where he's excited to come to the banquet. He says, "That's great. We'll do that." And in doing so, he has now tacitly agreed to her request. All right. Esther chapter 5, verses 9 through 14. Who has that? Brother Johnson.
Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him, "Have a pole set up reaching to the heights of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go to the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up.
All right. So, Haman is now plotting against Mordecai. And that idea of hanging Mordecai or impaling him, as we read in that version, is exactly what version of that is that, by the way, Brother Johnson?
NIV.
Okay, so the NIV gets it right. It is impaling. And as you can see in this picture, the capture of Lachish in 700 BC, that's in Sennacherib's palace at Nineveh. That's what hanging was. That's the people on the poles there. Somebody read for me Ezra chapter 6, verse 11. Who had that? Cole has that. While Cole's pulling that up, we'll go to that slide. Go ahead.
All right. Ezra chapter 6, verse 11. "Also, I make a decree that if anyone alters this edict, a beam shall be put out of his house, and he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made of a dunghill."
I've always liked how descriptive the language of the kings of this time were. We're going to pull a beam from his house and impale him on it, and his house shall be turned into a rubbish heap. they were very thorough, I guess you could say. All right. Yes, go ahead, Kyle.
One of the practices of ancient civilizations was that when nations were competing against nations, it was a defeat was solidified and victory assured by killing all of the family of the people that rose against them or the nation. We see that over and over again in the Old Testament. And the term that we see so often that's described is cut off from the land of the living. We certainly see that about the Lord when it was said of him in the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. But that's the way victory and power were solidified then, and so it's kind of the order of the day on how someone is defeated.
Yeah, and they like to be thorough about it. They like to make sure that nobody's going to come back from their family to kind of haunt them. And they're brutal people. This wooden utility pole in Nebraska is over 95 feet tall. At least another 10 feet is buried in the ground. That height of 75 feet is marked here. So you can see this is where the 75-foot mark is. That's 50 cubits. So that's how high the pole would have been that Haman set up to impale Mordecai on. This is an excavation of the outer courtyard of the palace at Susa. There are 8 foundation stones that each had a circular cavity. There's 5 of them visible in this photo. You can see them. They're marked here. The excavators understood these to be bases for wooden poles or pillars, which have long since disappeared. The circular holes are 3.5 to about 4 feet in diameter. A wooden pole with a base of this size could easily reach a height of 50 cubits. The function of these poles is not known. They may have been freestanding, or could have been incorporated as architectural elements, or they could have been used for the execution of enemies of the state. I have a link for more information about the use of these foundation stones, but let's go over to the slide of the model of the palace. And you can see here are, right there in that courtyard, the poles. And you can view, so somebody that was impaled on one of those would have been visible from outside the palace. It was a public execution. It was meant for everyone to see. All right. Haman starts out in verse 9 feeling pretty pleased with himself. He's received the personal attention of the queen. What happens to his mood immediately afterwards?
He's mad.
Okay, he drops into a fury when he sees Mordecai. Why is he mad at Mordecai? Okay, because he's there, and more importantly, he's there and
no respect,
not even a little bit of fear. So Mordecai knows that Haman is plotting to destroy him and his people. Remember, there have been public edicts, public decrees. Mordecai had a copy of it, and yet Mordecai shows absolutely no remorse, no concern, no fear. You get the impression that Haman would really like at least a little bit of trembling when he walks past, right? But it's like Haman, he's thinking to himself, I can't even buy this guy's respect. So, he drops into fury when he feels Mordecai is doomed. Surely he can at least look afraid. Let's pause to take an inverse lesson from Haman in verse 11. What does Haman decide to do to make himself feel better? Okay, he talks about his successes. He goes home and does what? He gathers together a bunch of people, and then?
He brags.
He regales them all with tales of his wealth. He regales them with his many sons, his honored position in the kingdom. Do we like self-assurance when we're feeling down? We do, don't we? We love it when you say, I've had a terrible day. I had to deal with this person who absolutely disrespected me. And you love people to say, oh, you know what? You're such a great person. You don't have to listen to that. You don't have to. There's no reason for you to be disrespected. We all love you. You're wonderful. We like that kind of reassurance, don't we? And so here Haman's kind of going on down the same road. He's, man, I'm an awesome guy. I've got all this stuff. I have tons. I've got money. I've got enough money that I can offer the king 10,000 talents to go exterminate a bunch of people. I've been successful in my home life. Look, count how many sons I have. I've been successful in my business life. I'm second in command in the kingdom. The king has honored me. I'm a great person. Who's this Mordecai guy? But he's having a hard time propping up that ego. And he reveals that in verse 13. What's the thorn that keeps popping that balloon? It's Mordecai. Yeah, his very existence brings him down. What does that tell you about the things that he's trying to use to make himself feel better? They don't work. They're a little bit shallow. It's not enough. As Christians, where are we to find joy? And before I get that question, let me ask you another question first. What's the difference between joy and happiness? Because that's an important distinction to make, isn't it? Happiness is temporal. Happiness is how we're feeling at any given moment. So what's joy? Joy is eternal. Joy is having is a mindset. You can have joy and not necessarily be in the happiest of circumstances. Who are some people who had joy even though they weren't in great circumstances? All right, Paul. Paul talks about his joy in spite of his circumstances, and we see evidence of that. Paul and Silas being locked up in prison, and they're doing what?
Singing.
They're singing. The book of James talks about having joy when you're in the middle of trials and tribulations. Joy, therefore, is not something that is based on what?
Circumstance.
It's not based on external factors. The external does not affect our joy. Joy is something internal. But what does Haman place his confidence in? All of these things that he has, his wealth, his sons, his position in the kingdom, is any of that internal? It's all external validation. And as we'll see in a little bit, it can all be taken away. And therefore, his joy can also be taken away. Go ahead, Claire.
I can't help but think of a parallel with Luke 12 with the rich man in his barns. Haman goes through kind of the same thing of like all of this stuff he thinks is because of him and because of the work he's done and because of what he's done, and he has no thankfulness. And he makes all these great plans for his future, and he doesn't realize that his soul is about to be required of him.
That's a very interesting parallel, and I hadn't thought about that, but you're right, it is. He's planned all this out, and he has all of these things, but it's about to be taken away from him. So as a result, what happens to his emotions? What happens to his happiness? It's kind of all over the place, isn't it? He can't be happy. And I think we see that in today's society. When people, they are flailing. They are looking for happiness. They are looking for something beyond them to make them happy. But the world doesn't make us happy. Joy comes from within. All right. And that's the lesson we should learn from Haman. So now Haman is going to be forced to honor Mordecai. Let's read Esther chapter 6, verses 1 through 9. Who has that one?
Esther chapter 6, verses 1 through 9. On that night,
the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "Well, the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal court crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials."
Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai, and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.
All right, went a little further, but that's okay. I heard some chuckling, and we all kind of feel the irony of the situation here, don't we? This is the tablet that the king's chronicles were written on and probably came from. I see Jim over here. I'll get you in just a second. So this is what it means when it says bringing in the book of records, kind of a big stone slab instead of a what we think of as a book. This tablet shown here is from the ninth year of Xerxes' reign, 477 BC. It is written in Akkadian, not Elamite, and it's an example of the cuneiform tablet from exactly the period in question. The Al-Yahudu tablets were purchased on the antiquities market and first came to the attention of scholars in the late 1990s. The group of over 200 tablets are from an unknown location in Mesopotamia and deal mainly with the activities of several communities of Jewish exiles, one of which was located in the town of Al-Yahudu. This tablet was photographed at the Bible Lands Museum in Jerusalem. All right, go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. So in Proverbs 1, verse 19, I think there's a scripture that goes along with what has happened here to Haman. It says, so are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. And so that could be symbolic, obviously, but in this case, I think there's some connection to a literal aspect of that truth in Proverbs. So that's one point. The other one is odds always fascinate me. And I think about the odds stacked against the Jews in this situation, right? Do you know, maybe I've missed it in the scripture, what was the percentage in this community or in this geographic area of Jews to non-Jews? Do you have a feel for that?
I don't know. I've never looked that up. I'm not sure how many of them were actually living in this area, but it was a fairly mixed population. We do know that.
Right. The reason I ask that is because I think in terms of, you mentioned how edicts had been proclaimed.
Yeah.
Right? Against the Jews. If I'm a Jew and they proclaim an edict that in 11 months everybody's going to die, is there a rising up at that point? Or is
public,
there
was definitely public mourning. We know that.
Yeah. Is there a, you know, let's get out of here kind of thing? You know, or was the providence of God, you know, they had such a faith that God would deliver them? I don't know. Maybe I'm asking questions that we can't answer, but I'm just curious about those things.
That's an interesting question. So the first thing we see is that there was a response to leadership. Mordecai puts on sackcloth and ashes. He refuses to go to he's not even allowed into the king's gate because he's dressed in sackcloth, and he publicly mourns. And the people, seeing Mordecai behaving in that way, follow along with it. Queen Esther then asks for a fast from the people. And we have indicates, they went along with it. The people fasted. And we get the idea that they then prayed with her. They have some time to work with. And as you can probably imagine, with any community of this size, we deal with what the larger group of people did, maybe rather than what individuals did. Were there some individuals who decided to pack up and flee? There may well have been. Were there some individuals who decided to declare that they weren't Jews? There may well have been. But the larger community of them stick together and they look to their leadership who's here in the land at this time, including people like Mordecai, who would have given them an indication of how they ought to behave. In fact, one of the complaints that modern rabbis have with the teachings of Jesus is that Jesus addresses the individual rather than the community. Jewish thought was very community focused. What are we doing as a people? What are we doing as a group? And in some respects, you see how God's laws tend to address the community specifically rather than individuals necessarily. We know that there were individuals, a remnant, who was preserved, and yet Godly widely condemns the community. So we have that same kind of mentality here, where the community is being addressed and behaving in a certain way, although individuals may, your experience may vary, kind of thing. Does that answer the question? Okay. So this relief is located on the northern side of the eastern staircase of the Apadana at Persepolis, and it's a procession of these Median and Persian dignitaries. So you can see their manner of dress and how they're presented. The text does not seem to indicate the king's personal crown being worn by Mordecai, but rather a crown that was placed on the head of a horse. And you can see here they put these fancy things on their heads. Note how the forelocks of the horses at this relief have been tied into splayed tufts. Now, you said something that I want to get into, actually. Sleep has evaded Xerxes that night. It's the night between the two banquets, right? So it is. We're on a specific timeline here. And it just so happens that Xerxes decides to do a bit of diving into the chronicles of recent events. Now, I don't know if he was thinking that this is going to put him to sleep, or if he's decided, sleep is, you know, there's no sleep tonight, we might as well just get on with the reading for the day. And it just so happens that in doing so, he comes across this record of Mordecai foiling a plot to overthrow him. So, I want to ask a question. Do you believe in luck? Do you believe in coincidence?
I believe in God's providence.
We believe in God's providence. Okay. Personally, I don't believe in luck as a concept at all. In fact, I've tried to remove the word luck from my vocabulary when talking to people. I don't want to say to somebody, good luck. Because that's not what I want them to have expressed. What kind of language can we replace that with? What are some other things we could say? What are some phrases that people used in the Bible instead of good luck?
If God wills.
If God wills.
May God bless you.
May God bless you. The Lord be with you. I think we get a little afraid sometimes of using God and language like that because we're concerned, rightly so, about taking the name of the Lord in vain. But people who were immersed in that kind of language and that kind of depiction of their faith, the Jews in the Old Testament, think about how David responded to people. He didn't say, good luck with that. He said, may the Lord be with you. May God bless your efforts. May the God whom I serve save you. Could we benefit from using that kind of language instead of saying good luck when we don't really mean that? I don't believe in fortune. I don't believe in coincidence. What I want you to see in this is the hand of God and his providence. We have a toss of the die that's going to determine what month this extermination occurs in. It gives the Jews 11 months to prepare. We have Xerxes that pulls up an event log and finds a record of Mordecai's loyalty. There's a level of orchestration. That's pattern. That's not random. And it's that kind of pattern that we can recognize in our own lives. But it's important that we make a distinction here. Providence is not, this happened to me and I concluded that God was telling me something. Providence is, this happened to me, and I, as a result, I saw these opportunities. And after prayer and consideration, I chose this, and the Lord has blessed me in that endeavor. Do you see the difference between the two? God doesn't speak to us directly the way he did through his prophets and other things in these times. And so we can't make assumptions about God's agency. Can you think of the times when God blessed someone in spite of a poor decision? What are some bad decisions that God turned into okay events or good events?
Joseph's brothers.
Okay, Joseph's brothers. That's my favorite one because Joseph's explicit about it. He says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That's exactly the example that I would go to. But we would hardly suggest that the Lord was responsible for our bad choices, would we? We don't say, God made me do this, when we're referring to something that we shouldn't have done. But we can see the providence of God coming to fruition when bad choices turn into good things. And then in a lovely bit of further providence, laced with no small amount of irony, we have this exchange between Xerxes and Haman that we're all chuckling at. Who is here? The king asks. Oh, there's Haman. Let's get his opinion on something. He's one of my top advisors. And then Haman, rather than asking, who do you want to honor? He just blithely assumes that the balm for his bruised ego has arrived. The king is going to honor me. Who would the king want to honor more than me? And neither Haman nor the king knows what the other one is thinking. And that's kind of funny. All right. Any other questions or comments before we go into the last few verses here in chapter 6? All right. We have just enough time to read Esther chapter 6, verses 10 through 14. So who has that reading? Go ahead, Scott.
Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. And while they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared.
All right. Since we've only got about a minute left, I'm going to go ahead and put a pause here and say, do we have any other questions or comments on what we've gone through so far? Go ahead, Jim.
I was only going to say that this is a perfect example of pride going before a fall.
Perfect example of pride going before a fall. That is a principle that we rely on, isn't it? It's something that we look at and we say that God will humble the proud. And he's been known to do that in the scriptures before, hasn't he? It's not like he stops today. We need to make sure that we are not proud, lest God humble us. Anything else? All right. If not, thank you for your kind attention. We'll pick up here at the end of chapter 6 next week.